Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling a really interesting Florida Supreme Court case, Wilson v. Palm Beach County Housing Authority from 1987.
Ah, yes. A pivotal case.
It really is. This decision is pretty key for understanding how Florida municipalities can finance public housing without necessarily needing, you know, a public vote on the bonds they issue.
Exactly. The core of this case really boils down to this.
Yeah.
Under what specific circumstances can a housing authority issue bonds that are secured by mortgages on the housing itself, using only the revenue from those projects to pay off the debt, without triggering the Florida Constitution's requirement for voter approval? It's a vital question for anyone looking at, say, public finance or affordable housing initiatives in the state.
Absolutely. And for you listening, maybe you're prepping for law school exams, trying to get a handle on this area of law, or just curious about how these things actually work. We're going to break down the essentials of this case. Our goal is to give you a solid grasp of this important legal precedent.
Sounds good.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning. What was the situation, the factual scenario that led to this case?
Well, the backdrop was fairly straightforward, actually. The Palm Beach County Housing Authority wanted to build some low-income housing, standard goal. Their plan to finance this involved issuing revenue bonds.
Okay.
Now, this is where it gets interesting. These bonds were specifically structured to be repaid only from the income the housing projects would generate, you know, rent payments mainly.
Right.
And to make these bonds more secure for investors, which you need to do, they were to be backed by mortgages on the housing properties themselves.
So wait, if the rental income wasn't enough, the bondholders could potentially take possession of the properties? Is that the idea?
That's exactly the idea. That was a security mechanism. And, well, this plan didn't go unchallenged. A citizen named Craig Wilson raised objections.
Yeah.
He argued that this financing method went against the Florida Constitution.
Okay, and what happened in the courts initially? Did they shut it down?
No, actually. The trial court gave the housing authority the green light, validating the bond issuance. But Wilson wasn't satisfied with that decision and took his case directly to the Florida Supreme Court.
Now, before we get into the weeds of the legal arguments, there's a really crucial characteristic of this housing authority we need to understand, right? You mentioned it briefly.
Absolutely essential. You have to grasp this. The Palm Beach County Housing Authority had no power to levy taxes. Zero.
None at all.
None. This means they couldn't directly use taxpayer money to pay back these bonds. And this absence of taxing authority, well, it becomes a central pillar of the court's eventual ruling.
Okay, so given that, what was Wilson's main argument? Why did he believe this financing plan was unconstitutional if taxpayer money wasn't directly involved?
Wilson's main point was that by securing the bonds with mortgages on the housing projects, it created what he saw as an indirect obligation for the taxpayers.
An indirect one? How so?
His worry was that if the projects faced financial difficulties, maybe occupancy was low, rents weren't coming in, there would be significant political or moral pressure on the county government to step in with public funds to prevent potential foreclosures.
Ah, okay.
He contended that this potential pressure, this sort of implicit backstop, acted as an unconstitutional pledge of public credit, essentially using the county's good name and potential resources to benefit the private bondholders.
That makes sense. Even if it's not a direct legal obligation, the political reality could be, well, awkward. The county might feel compelled to act to avoid, you know, a big mess with low-income housing.
Exactly. You could see the headlines.
So how did the housing authority push back against this line of reasoning?
Well, the housing authority argued pretty forcefully that the repayment of these bonds was strictly and legally tied to the financial performance of the housing projects themselves, the rental income, and crucially, the value of the properties secured by the mortgages.
Right.
Because they lacked the power to tax, they asserted there was simply no legal pathway for taxpayer money to be used for repayment or to prevent a foreclosure. So in their view, no public credit was being pledged, period. Not directly, not indirectly.
All right, we've got the basic setup laid out. The authority wants to build housing with bonds backed by mortgages paid by rent. Wilson says the mortgage part indirectly pledges public credit. The authority says no taxing power, no pledge. Now let's dig into the core legal issue. What was the central constitutional question the Florida Supreme Court had to resolve here?
The fundamental legal question really zeroed in on Article 7, Section 10 of the Florida Constitution. That's the key provision.
And what does that section generally do?
It generally prohibits the state and its subdivisions, counties, municipalities, authorities like this one, from lending or pledging their public credit to aid private entities unless it serves a paramount public purpose. It's about protecting taxpayer funds.
Okay. And how did Wilson's legal team argue that these specific mortgage-backed bonds violated that particular constitutional provision?
Wilson's argument, as we touched on, centered on this idea of coercion. He contended that the mere existence of these mortgages would inevitably coerce Palm Beach County into using public funds if the housing project started to fail.
Right, the pressure argument again.
Exactly. The logic was, look, the county wouldn't want to see a significant low-income housing development go into foreclosure. Think about the potential displacement of residents, other social issues that might arise. Therefore, any action the county might take to prevent this disaster, even without a direct legal obligation to do so, would effectively constitute an indirect pledging of public credit, mainly benefiting the bondholders who would get paid back.
So the concern wasn't just about the strict legal mechanics of the bond repayment contract, but also about the, let's say, downstream potential for the county to feel pressured into intervening financially.
Precisely. It was about that potential indirect drain on public resources triggered by the mortgage security. Now, the Housing Authority had to refute this. What was the core of their legal defense against this coercion claim?
Well, their main defense, as we've established, was their complete lack of taxing authority. How did they leverage that specific fact in their legal argument to counter Wilson's claims?
Their counterargument really, really hinged on this. Because they had no power to levy taxes, they argued there was simply no legal mechanism, no channel by which taxpayer funds could be used. Not to directly repay the bonds, and not to step in and prevent a foreclosure either. Mm. The financial responsibility for these bonds was, in their view, legally ring-fenced. It was confined strictly to the project's revenues and the value tied up in the mortgage properties. Therefore, they argued, the constitutional prohibition on pledging public credit just wasn't even triggered in this scenario.
It really seems like that lack of taxing power was the absolute linchpin of their whole argument. Let's move on then to how the court actually dealt with this, especially considering there were previous rulings on kind of similar issues. What prior Florida Supreme Court cases did they have to wrestle with?
Yeah, that's important context. There were two key precedents that the Florida Supreme Court definitely had to consider in the Wilson case. One was Boykin v. Town of River Junction, and the other was Knorr v. Brevard County Educational Facilities Authority.
Okay.
These cases had already established a certain legal landscape regarding issuing bonds and this whole question of pledging public credit. So the court in Wilson had to either, you know, follow those precedents, distinguish this case, or maybe even modify the previous rules.
Okay, let's take Boykin first. What was the crucial aspect of that case that was relevant here?
In Boykin, the critical factor, the thing that made it different, was that the entity issuing the bonds did have the power to levy taxes.
Okay. Opposite situation.
Exactly. Because of that taxing authority, the court in Boykin reasoned that there was a tangible, real potential risk to the taxpayers if the bond obligations weren't met from project revenues. Therefore, they ruled that voter approval was required for those bonds. Boykin essentially established a pretty clear link. Power to tax equals potential risk to public credit, equals need for public consent via vote.
That makes perfect sense. If you have the power to reach into taxpayers' pockets, directly or indirectly, then the taxpayers should logically have a say on big financial commitments. Now, what about the other case, Knorr? What specific concerns did that case bring up?
Knorr was interesting because it introduced this concern about the potential for coercion to tax, even in situations where the bonds weren't directly backed by taxes, kind of like the argument Wilson was making.
Right.
In that case, the court worried that if projects financed by these sorts of bonds, particularly projects serving an obvious public purpose, like educational facilities, were to fail, there could be such significant public pressure on the government to intervene financially that it would effectively amount to an indirect pledge of public credit, even without taxing power directly involved in the bond structure.
So Knorr kind of expanded the court's focus beyond just the direct legal obligation. It started considering the potential for, like, political and social pressures to lead to the use of taxpayer funds anyway.
Precisely. They were looking at the practical realities, the potential financial implications for taxpayers down the road, even without a direct legal guarantee in the bond documents. Now, this is where Wilson marks a really significant departure, or maybe a clarification is a better word. What was the key difference in the Wilson case that allowed the court to reach a different conclusion than the vibe in Knorr?
Well, it seems to keep coming back to the housing authority's lack of taxing power. How did the court use that specific fact to differentiate Wilson from the coercion concerns raised in Knorr?
Exactly right. Justice Overton, who wrote the majority opinion in Wilson, directly took on that coercion to tax argument that was sort of hovering after Knorr. He emphasized that the mere existence of mortgages securing bonds doesn't automatically equate to a pledge of public debt. The crucial distinction, he argued, was that the Palm Beach County Housing Authority had absolutely no legal authority to levy taxes. Without that power, the court reasoned, the kind of coercive pressure they worried about in Knorr was significantly diminished, maybe even entirely absent as a legal possibility. The county couldn't be legally compelled to tax for this purpose.
That's a really important distinction they drew. And didn't the court actually explicitly step back from some of the reasoning in Knorr as part of the Wilson ruling? I seem to recall that.
Yes, you're absolutely right. That was a big move. The court explicitly stated that it receded from the Knorr decision, but importantly, only to the extent that Knorr's reasoning was inconsistent with the logic they were laying out in Wilson.
Okay, so not throwing Knorr out entirely, but refining it.
Exactly. It was a clear signal that the court was adjusting its approach, aiming to give more flexibility to housing authorities using this specific type of financing structure, provided the key safeguard no taxing power was in place.
So out of the Wilson decision, the court essentially created a clear pathway, a set of conditions that, if met, would mean these mortgage-backed revenue bonds for public housing don't require voter approval. Can you lay out those key conditions for us?
Yes, they established a very clear three-part test. It's quite straightforward. First, the housing authority in this case must lack the power to levy taxes. That's non-negotiable.
Number one, no taxing power. Got it.
Second, there must be no pledge of the government's credit, either direct or indirect. The structure must avoid any entanglement with general government funds or guarantees.
Number two, no pledge of credit, direct or indirect.
And third, the bonds must be repayable solely from two sources. The revenues generated by the project itself, the rents, and the proceeds if the mortgages on that specific project have to be foreclosed upon.
Number three, repayment strictly from project revenues and mortgage proceeds.
That's it. If and only if all three of those conditions are satisfied, then voter approval is not constitutionally required under Article 7, Section 10 of the Florida Constitution.
That's a really helpful summary. So if a housing authority can confidently check all three of those boxes, they can proceed with this type of financing without going through a potentially difficult public referendum. Okay, now let's shift gears slightly and think about the real-world impact. Why is this Wilson ruling actually significant, particularly for the practicalities of developing affordable housing?
The significance of Wilson for affordable housing initiatives in Florida is pretty substantial. Mm. It essentially provided a more streamlined and potentially much faster way for housing authorities to secure the financing needed for crucial projects.
How so? Streamlined?
Well, by removing the requirement for a public vote in these very specific circumstances, it allowed them to bypass a process that can often be lengthy, quite costly, and frankly, subject to unpredictable political winds.
Right. Referendums can be tough.
Definitely. So this allowed housing authorities, in theory, to be more nimble and responsive to the often pressing needs for affordable housing in their communities.
But it sounds like we need to be careful here. This is a very specific exception, right? There are definitely limits to when this pathway can actually be used.
Absolutely. This isn't some kind of blanket authorization for all revenue bonds, not by a long shot. It's a carefully, narrowly defined exception. If the issuing authority does have the power to tax, even if they promise not to use it for these bonds.
Even if they promise.
Well, the existence of the power might be enough to trigger the Boykin precedent. Or if there's any indication that public funds could potentially be used to support the bonds in any way, maybe some hidden guarantee or a moral obligation pledge, then the Wilson exception almost certainly wouldn't apply and voter approval would very likely be required.
So that lack of taxing authority really is the absolute key that unlocks this particular financing mechanism. Fascinating. What does the Wilson case tell us, maybe more broadly, about how Florida law views the concept of public purpose? Does it shed light on that?
I think it does. The Wilson decision can be seen as reflecting a broader trend, maybe, in Florida law, where courts have shown a greater willingness to defer to the judgment of municipalities when they are tackling significant social issues like housing shortages.
A bit more deference to local government.
Perhaps. As long as these initiatives operate clearly within constitutional boundaries, and the big one here is protecting taxpayers from undue financial risk, the courts seem more inclined to recognize these efforts as serving a legitimate public purpose.
So it suggests the courts definitely recognize the critical need for things like affordable housing.
Exactly. But the crucial element highlighted so clearly by Wilson is that this recognition often comes with that really important caveat. Taxpayer funds must be appropriately and legally safeguarded. The absence of taxing power was the critical factor that allowed the court to reconcile the acknowledged public purpose of affordable housing with the constitutional prohibition against pledging public credit. Without that bright line, no taxing power, the potential for financial risk to taxpayers, even indirect or coercive, would likely have tipped the scales the other way in the court's constitutional analysis.
That really clarifies how the taxing power, or lack thereof, is so central to the court's whole reasoning about potential coercion and risk. And just to nail this down one last time, in this specific Wilson context, the mortgages were acting purely as collateral, as security for the bondholders, but they did not create a debt or a liability for Palm Beach County or the state of Florida, correct?
That's a very important point to emphasize, yes. The mortgages served as collateral. They made the bonds more attractive to investors, gave them some security, and provided a mechanism for repayment if the project's own revenues weren't sufficient. However, the court was very clear in stating that in this particular scenario, structured this way, these mortgages did not establish a debt or any kind of financial obligation for the county government or the state. The repayment obligation remained solely with the housing authority and was legally tied only to the success of that specific housing project and the value of that specific mortgage property.
This has been a really clear and helpful explanation. For our listeners who are law students, maybe deep in constitutional law or local government law, what's the single most important takeaway you think they should get from Wilson v. Palm Beach County Housing Authority?
The most important takeaway for law students. I'd say Wilson offers a really valuable practical illustration of how courts navigate that often tricky intersection between important public policy goals like, yes, creating affordable housing and fundamental constitutional principles like protecting the public purse from risky ventures through the prohibition against pledging public credit.
That balancing act.
Exactly. It underscores the critical need to understand the nuances, the fine details of public finance law, and the specific limitations imposed by state constitutions. The case really highlights that just declaring something a public purpose isn't always enough. The method chosen for financing that purpose, and especially the potential impact on taxpayers, are equally crucial legal considerations.
That's great advice. So, to quickly recap our deep dive into Wilson v. Palm Beach County Housing Authority, this 1987 case created a specific but narrow exception to the general requirement of voter approval for revenue bonds secured by mortgages. But, and it's a big but, this exception depends critically on the issuing authority completely lacking the power to tax, and the bonds being structured so they're repayable solely from the project's own revenues and the proceeds from the mortgages themselves.
Precisely. It's a narrow but significant avenue for financing public housing in Florida, carved out by the court under specific conditions.
Right. And with that, here's maybe a final thought for you, our listener, to consider. As we continue to grapple with really pressing social needs like affordable housing, how might the legal landscape surrounding public finance continue to evolve? What other potentially innovative financing mechanisms might emerge from municipalities trying to solve these problems? And importantly, what kinds of legal challenges, maybe echoing Wilson or Knorr, might they face as they strive to address these needs within existing constitutional frameworks? It's definitely a space worth watching.
Absolutely. And we certainly encourage anyone interested to delve further into related cases and legal scholarship. There's a lot more depth to explore in the complexities of public finance and constitutional law, especially in Florida.
Great point. Well, thanks for joining us for this deep dive. We look forward to exploring another fascinating legal topic with you next time.